Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. I think one thing that we're really grateful for lockdown is like just the ability to still be able to connect and talk about books, because in many ways books have kept us sane and books has been what has kept us going. And today we're going to have a wonderful, wonderful conversation with an essay literary fave. Dr. A, how are you doing before we introduce our guest?
I'm okay. I've had quite a interesting week, I suppose. I'm okay. I think the pandemic is just teaching us to be okay with being okay. You're just okay and you're okay with being okay. But I'm super excited for today's conversation. We just have the inimitable author of some of our favorite books. I am still waiting for a sequel on the one book, but that is a matter of discussion for another day. I just want to put it out there into the universe. But I really have the pleasure of introducing today Angela Makolo, who is the author of so many loved thrillers, her novels Red Ink, The 30th Candle, Black Widow Society, and the internationally acclaimed The Blessed Girl, which was nominated for a UK-based prize, are some of the most interesting books that we've had the pleasure of coming across this year. And so have the joy of introducing Angela to the Cheeky Natives, and we're going to discuss her latest novel, Critical But Stable, which is what so many of us have been during this lockdown.
Yes, you can say that again. I was feeling very critical but stable this morning. So which is why I couldn't join at the time that we're supposed to be together. But here we are. We all, you know, keeping on.
I suppose our first question is, Angela, you are known as someone who writes like, you know, crime thriller type novels, right? And your last two books have sort of departed away from that. And I suppose what is the reason for venturing outside of what you have gripped us onto, because we want more of that? What was the reason for you to venture out of that?
I don't know. I mean, I think writing is expression. So I don't think about whether I'll be writing a thriller or, you know, whatever genre, comedy or whatever it is. I just write what it is that is burning in my soul that needs to be said, that needs to be put on paper. So it's not a decision. It's more kind of, I don't know, an inclination, a need, if you will. I don't really think about genres. I think very few artists, when they, you know, venture out into the world with a new work of art, it is very rare that an artist is thinking, like, even, I don't know, I'm sure even musicians and singers, I don't think you're thinking, you know, I want to stick to this genre, I'm going to write this book, which is another thriller. I think you just write what you feel, what feels right at that particular, you know, time in your life. Although good news, if it is good news for the thriller lovers, is that I do have a huge, very intense thriller brewing in my head. So we'll see. Watch the space. Maybe there's something for those who love, dark grit and all of that. So yeah.
I mean, I think that your books show that you are quite a keen observer of people. So I think that you are like a people watcher and you're really good at watching human interaction and like writing down. So I want to know what your writing process is like, especially for a book like Critical But Stable, which I feel like is based on so many people that we know just put together.
My writing process, I mean, it all starts with an idea. I mean, this one actually started with a conversation with my husband, actually. And he was telling me a story about, a story that's very similar to the opening chapter of the book. And I thought that is quite fascinating. But I had been thinking of writing a book about marriage, especially long-term marriage, you know. And I wanted to talk about the things that people never want to talk about. So I just thought, and I suppose it was a nice little segue into my love of of the thrill, of the darker aspects of, I don't know, humanity. So I found it quite a great kind of inroad into kind of the bigger picture of these three couples, and what is happening within those specific relationships. So I write mostly at night, because I've got a day job, like most of us local writers, I've got a day job. I write in bed. I started writing intensely on this book. I started writing this book more intensely during the hard lockdown. I think the hard lockdown for creativity was actually a huge blessing, because I know a lot of my fellow authors did a lot of writing during that time, which is probably why there's so many books coming out now and, you know, late last year. So it was terrible for humanity, but I think for creativity, it was actually a huge boon, because you had time. You had a lot of time. You had silence. You had, you know, meditative space, a space where you could really think about things, you know? So I wrote it like well into the night. I would sleep at 2 a.m. with my glass of red wine. So if there's weird things happening, there's the red wine probably. So, yeah.
I think you do quite a lot of work in Critical But Stable. You know, for a lot of people, it may appear to be a light read, you know, just venturing into it. But you actually do a lot of work. I think one of the major things that you do is a real criticism of like the capitalistic society that we live in, and how in many ways this capitalistic society makes us become people who seem to yearn for more, but never yearn for more. And so this idea of meet the Kumalos, right, in is really interesting. And I wanted to know, why was it important for you to think about capitalism in the way that you think about in the book?
I think where it comes from, and I think there's similar themes in The Blessed Girl, is that, you know, I am kind of a middle-class South African, a Black South African, and I'm just seeing just a huge shift in the way that Black people specifically live. And as we kind of climb, I don't know, the corporate ladder, the social ladder, there's just so much that is shifting in terms of just even our value system and the way we relate to one another. I don't want to romanticize, I don't know, our Africanism, but there's certainly now a more kind of selfish, you know, outlook to just, you know, carrying on about life. There's far less of that Ubuntu. I know it's a cliche kind of word, but for lack of a better word, just there's more distancing from the communal, from, you know, those kind of values, to this very materialistic and consumerist kind of culture. So, I mean, I feel that it's just changing so many things in the way that we live our lives, just even in terms of how we even form our family units, how we relate to each other as family, as friends, as co-workers. And I mean, I think it's something that worries me. I think it concerns me. It just feels like a shrinking away from something that is really beautiful about being an African, being an African person. And I think these reflections, even though they are kind of couched in these light, kind of comic or satirical narratives, but at the heart of it is me wanting us to kind of scrutinize who we are becoming with kind of a sharper lens, you know? And I think by framing it in that kind of humorous, satirical style, it makes it more accessible, because I want us to talk about it. I want people, a lot of us, to talk about it. I don't want it to be like this kind of eyebrow conversation, you know?
So I think it's interesting that you spoke about the reframing, right, particularly in these capitalist societies, because when I was reading this, I was thinking of, like, Mashidi and Salamzi. And I mean, there's like an ostentatiousness there, right? And this like lavish lifestyle. But I also think the greatest question for me is, and I said this to the Clock on the Loft, you know, I was like, I think that Angela's asking us to rethink what we think success looks like within these capitalist frameworks, right? That say you must tick off the boxes and you must have the house in Mshlanga, the holiday home in Mshlanga, and your children must all go to St. John's or Dean. But I want to know, for you having written this book, being a middle class black woman, right? What are some of your reflections on the ideas of success and achievements, particularly in the context that we are now operating in, right? We've had Corona. I mean, we saw there's a repossession that takes place in the book, and I was laughing because I'm like, goodness, this must be the lives of so many people right now. Like, how true to time is this, you know? So I want from you what your reflections on the idea of success and achievements looks like outside of these frameworks that you so clearly show in the book.
Yeah, I mean, COVID has definitely forced all of us. I mean, I think it's rare. It would be the rare person who's not had time to really kind of recalibrate the way that we look at life. We look at what you're saying, our ideals of what success looks like, of what a happy life looks like. So that's the one thing that this book, and also conversations with people around this book. I mean, I'm so glad to be living at a time when we really are having very sharp discourse around these kind of issues. I'm learning a lot actually talking about this book from readers, because, you know, every time a new person kind of comments, there's always a revelation. There's always something new that comes out of that discussion. And so for me, the main thing that I am now kind of urgently thinking about in terms of even my life and the way that I do things is just this idea of happiness. What is it that constitutes, you know, a happy life? You know, is it having, you know, material success? Is it having, even if it's not material success, I suppose accolades, you know, recognition, all of this stuff that kind of traditionally, especially in a consumerist society, are the hallmarks of what we think success looks like. And I'm at a time where I'm finding myself looking for spaces to meditate, to, like, I'm looking more solid for more solitude. Kind of a, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of a more spiritual in terms of really understanding who I am in the world, what it is that matters to me, you know, family, friends, love, life, you know, just, it's the cliched thing that actually makes life happen. It's just simplicity. It's, having a great meal with a friend. It's, you know, sitting around with your family, and talking, chatting, playing games. It really is kind of distilling, like, the quality of life is being distilled to, like, the very things that we've been taking for granted for so long.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
There's also a meditation that you do on sisterhood. I think one of my favorite sort of moments in the book was, you know, this idea of, like, we're not only siblings, but we're also friends. And as we grow older, our relationship sort of morphs into us becoming more friends than siblings. So we're able to have really difficult conversation and we're able to be vulnerable with each other. And I was really interested about that idea, right? Because we often think about, like, how Black womanhood, particularly in writing, Black women are often written as these people who are not able to get along. And sometimes a good story is a sibling rivalry. So you don't like me because I'm more successful than you. But in the book, you don't do that, right? So the sisters are really like a close-knit type of sisters. Yes, there is a larger meditation on sisterhood because these people who belong to this high-end Stockfell are all together, because Gistokfele at the end of the day, right? Like, we can call it what it is, but Gistokfele. They have this relationship.
Love, my darling.
But the meditation on sisterhood was something that stood out really powerfully for me in the book. Like, these people were sort of there for each other and were able to guide each other. And I wanted to speak a little bit about that. Why was it important for you to unearth that sort of sisterhood in an adult relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think, personally, I have to confess that it's actually a personal, it's a longing of mine. I don't have a sister. And I do find a lot of comfort in my relationships with other females, with my friends, for instance. And so it is something that I think I've always longed for. Since I could remember, I don't know, since I was a young girl. And, the space that Mushidi and Lerato, I don't know, it's a very free space. You know, when they're together, there's that sense of trust. Like, this person, I can tell them anything about my life. They're not going to judge me, and they know me. Like, this is somebody who's known me since, you know, I was a small child, or since I was born. And so that sense of trust. And I think, I do love, that aspect of female friendships, like that sisterhood, even if it's not a genetic sisterhood, like that sense of connection, because it does so much, especially for Black women. It does a lot because of patriarchy. There's so much that Black women go through in relationships. Like, there's so much that they deal with. And that space is a very, it's comforting. It's like therapy. It's very therapeutic. Because it allows you to kind of offload all of the things that you sometimes can't talk about. You can't talk about with a colleague, you can't talk about with your husband or your partner, or, you know. And so it's quite an important, I love, you know, friendships. I think most of my books, except for Winter Who Stole her friend's name, but most of my other books do kind of feature aspects of that, because I think those friendships are so freeing, you know, they liberate and they give you a space to just be yourself. And especially if, like I'm saying, it's a long-term friendship like that of the sisters, that it comes with also a sense of safety. You feel safe to be yourself with that person.
I think it's such a beautiful thing that you explored female friendship, right? So I think that friendships between women get a bad rep. I think women are the only people who aren't allowed to actually dislike each other, you know? We'll just be told that, you see, women always want to bring each other down.
Yeah.
Typical, you know, we're not allowed to actually just dislike each other or be different. But I think that there's such a contrast between the two characters who have the strongest friendship, right? So when you think of Lerato as like a good girl gone bad, almost, you know, and there's an evolution of character in Lerato that you see, you know? And then you think of like Mushidi, who is just, Mushidi's like the rich aunt, you know. Mushidi is just your ballin' aunt that will come there. It's probably the subject of all those TikToks, you know. They're like, you know, in her nice car. But I think that the contrast in the characters for me is interesting. I want to talk a little bit about Lerato, right? Because Lerato is, in many ways, the good girl gone bad. I mean, the Tlhokonolo loves him because we actually watched Lerato involve.
My favorite girl, you know, my favorite girl, like Lerato. Yo, my favorite girl.
I've had hits on me because of what happened to Lerato. People are like, no. Like, people are like, I'm not talking to you. I'm still not happy. We need to talk.
Truly. And I want to talk about that because we watched an evolution in Lerato's character, right? So Lerato is like the religious almost repressed girl, and there's an evolution of her character, because Lerato is the one person who you would never ever think would be unfaithful to her partner, and yet she is. And so I want to talk about that character, so the evolution of that character, but also why did her story end in the way that it did? Because as she's really coming into her own, how Jiggy Jiggy paid Lerato,
Jumi, also we must address Angela, man. Like Lerato, oh yeah, man, we must address Angela. And also Lenebata, like now I said here.
What do you want from me?
I'm ready to ask you. I'm sitting here and I'm like, but what did we want Lerato to do? Guys, Munahara was putting her through the most. What did we want Lerato to do?
Why
be the one who's like, you know, yeah, he must die. Why couldn't
he die? Why couldn't you get rid of Mzaya? Like,
and that was a problem in my life.
You are the problem in our lives, Angela, yeah, because of what she did to
I go to the TRC, what do they call those trials those Nazi trials, the Nuremberg
trials? The Nuremberg trials, yes. Oh, accounts, keep accounts.
Let it go. They did the cleansing.
We were observing. We were not cleansed. No. Please account for what she did. Please account for what she did to Lerato. Please.
Look, Lerato. Lerato's story and her evolution, it is beautiful. I mean, she's somebody who really worked hard to be kind of Miss Goody Two Shoes, to be like the perfect woman, the perfect wife, the perfect mom, the perfect employee. You know what I mean? So for a long time, and I think if Mzwandile hadn't now declared that he's off sex forever, you know, we wouldn't have even gotten to see the side of her. She would not have known that she even had it in her to pursue a relationship with somebody else outside of the marriage. She would, if Mzwandile didn't have a sexual issue, she'd have probably, even if it was bad sex, she was gonna just tolerate the bad sex until she died, you know. And then she'll find out later that, oh, there's actually different ways to actually make love other than what she experienced in her marriage with Mzwandile. That's how, you know, that's kind of like it, the kind of person we're talking about when we talk about Lerato. So why her? Well, to be honest, I actually don't have a very deeply philosophical reason for that, except for the fact that from the very beginning, when I plotted this novel with the body at the beginning, Lerato was always my victim, unfortunately. And I did toy, you know, as you know how stories, when you write stories, meander off into directions that you never expected. So when Norma started having this thing for Tahadzwa, the business partner, I was thinking, maybe it should be, because also Norma was irritating me. Hey, she was annoying me. I'm like, Norman, this is the bitch that's gonna die. You know? And at some point, but I just could not. I just thought, you know, I also fell in love with Lerato like a lot of people. And I knew that it would just have more of a punch if it were her and not somebody like Norma or even Mushidi. So Mushidi, you know, she had her own problems with her man selling her off to the highest bidder. So I just thought she's suffering enough in her own little corner there. So story.
Suffering. She was being deprived of sex. She was also suffering. She was in this like sexist marriage.
She did enjoy a great, like an orgasmic sexual life for a brief period before. You know, and also remember, she wasn't even killed, guys. I mean, she even died of natural causes. What do you want from me? I mean, if I had killed her,
if we didn't want her to kill her.
Then I would understand the wrath that I'm getting from Rita. I would totally get it.
I think that wrath makes a lot of sense. I mean, I want to talk a little bit about Lawrence as well. Yes, I don't know how you could do this to Lerato, because I was reading this, I'm like, oh, how Lerato got her groove back. She's going to leave this man and just
put in the house.
Flourish, Kappy King. It was a Kalukogi type, you know, we're going to see her in like those tiny little skirts.
You're seeing other step steps to the evolution. You're like, okay, what's next, Lerato?
You know, but I thought that Lerato's case was also sad because you think of like how women, how Black women particularly, or are always assigned like a role, right? So you're somebody's daughter, then you become somebody's wife, then you become somebody's mother, right? And there is this lack of like identity outside of these roles that people are assigned to, you know? And then you think about how so many Black women have to wait until they are in Lerato's age or even older before they really come into their own. So before you're able to just have hobbies and like just live, you know, and even if that living means getting up to mischief. And for me, I think Lerato was really sad because there are so many women like her that we know who've been repressed by like religion and patriarchy, etc., and live in these very neat boxes and often have to wait until they're quite old, right, before they can come into some semblance of their own, right? And then I think of Lawrence, you know. I mean, did Lawrence is interesting because did he really love Lerato? Was he infatuated with Lerato? I want to explore a little bit of that relationship because there's also like a portion that she did. Lawrence is a foreigner.
Because Lawrence loved Lerato. Lawrence loved Lerato. Like, he really did.
What makes really, you think that he loved him? Her?
His behavior after. Okay, let's, I mean, of course, the relationship that they were, that they had was hot and steamy. It was new. It was fresh.
Yeah.
So, yes, you could say, there were elements of infatuation there, but who amongst us is not infatuated in the first stages of a relationship?
But I want to play a little bit of a devil.
I need to look at what his behavior after Lerato passed on, like after she died. There's so many things he would have done differently if he was just there for the excitement, and then, you know, you get that and then life goes on. He would have acted very differently. But you see the way that he reacts even to the family reaching out to him. I mean, if I were him and I knew that the cops are already kind of like breathing down my neck, I'd be like, hey, you know what? I'm busy. It's okay. So he definitely had a strong kind of emotional attachment to this woman. He was looking forward to kind of seeing bigger things, you know, coming up. Maybe he was hoping he'd get her out of the marriage and run off to the sunset with her. So he definitely was, like, I mean, if you look at his behavior after she was gone, I think it's a good indicator of where his heart lay. You know?
I also want to play a little bit of devil's advocate, right, and say, I'm starting to believe that we like to position infatuation as, like, a necessarily a bad thing, like, you know, it's fleeting. But what if we think of Lawrence and Lerato's love affair as an affair of desire, right? So the way that Lawrence was acting towards Lerato and Lerato to Lawrence wasn't necessarily an infatuation. These people truly desired each other. I've been thinking a lot about like what it means to be a woman or a person in Lerato's shoes, right? Lerato's in this marriage and Lerato is a young woman whose libido is going strong and her husband is not desiring her, right? For what we will talk about, because we need to talk about the asexuality, because I think that was really such an important moment to lift up in the book, right? But I think Lerato, more than anything, wanted to be desired. And I know how it feels when people don't desire you, right? Like where you just want to be desired for your person. And I feel like Lerato and Lawrence's love for me elevated this desire.
That's a very important point that you're touching on, because you know, I think there's something that we don't talk about as well in society is the invisibility of women as they get older. As women get older, they become invisible. It's like you're just there. You're not a sexual being. We don't expect it. We kind of like disgusted. No man, you know, you see somebody like Skolopat. You remember that woman called Skolopat? I was actually just on Instagram and I just came across it and I was like, hey, this woman. But then as I'm looking through her feed and everything, and I'm like thinking, this person is, I don't know how old she is, but she's free in her body, you know? She's free in her sexuality. And it's the one thing that as you get into your 40s, your 50s, and your 60s, especially in Black society, in African society, we do not want a sexy black woman and all that, what are you doing? You know? And so that invisibility is gradual. And if you are invisible to your own husband, I mean, you know, can you imagine, like, okay, you're already invisible to society. So that kind of expects that it happens. You're no longer sexy girl and whatever. But now at home, you are the person that is at least supposed to have that sustained affection for you, does not see you. I mean, the fact that his reason for not seeing her, in his own explanation, is that, is because of his sexual orientation. It could be that reason. It could be that somebody is having an affair out there or prefers now younger women, or, and it does not touch you. So you're in this place, in the space where you are supposed to experience all those amazing things that life offers when you're in an intimate relationship with somebody, the passion, you know, exploring your sexuality together. And instead of getting that, you're getting nothing. You ain't getting none. And we don't talk about how that would affect a woman, because a lot of the conversation around changes in intimacy between married couples, between whether, you know, like older married couples, it's usually focused on the man. It's like, oh, a man has needs. And you, mama, hey, if the woman doesn't satisfy you, you need a side chick. And of course now, I mean, it's almost, it comes with a turf. It's like, it's almost an expectation, you know? And so when you flip the script and it's happening on the woman's side of the equation, the conversation is different. I mean, I remember we were having this discussion at a book club, and there were men and there were women. And some women, I don't know if they really feel that way. They were like, no. If I were in the rapper's shoes, I just, you know, because I'm a Christian woman and I'm married to this man, I would just sit out the drought, you know, because through thick and thin, better or worse. But that's what society expects you to say. That's what I think. I don't know if they were saying it because we're in a public forum, because the moderator literally went out and said, okay, guys, you are Lerato. What would you do? What would you do? What would you do? And quite a few of the women were like, I get a gift for better or worse. I would just have to play with myself or buy a vibrator or just...
But even that, right? So Lerato buys a vibrator because she doesn't want to defy her marriage. And she's still shamed for that, right? And it's also interesting how women are expected to be the ones who are supposed to beg Ezela and for better and for worse. Where not just say you are asexual or you're premenopausal or you're menopausal. Your husband is going to be like,
try.
My dad needs, so I'm a go out, right? I'm a go out, and it's expected for you to say.
So it's not a conversation. It's like, I mean, obvs, like, what am I supposed to do, you know?
And so in many ways, I was grateful that Lerato stepped out of her marriage, right? Because I was just like, yes, can like black women be the ones who do this? And on the same vein, I don't want to say grateful, but I was really like impressed that when we speak about asexuality, we speak about asexuality towards the men. Because the way masculinity is constructed, and particularly black masculinity, we sort of have this idea that black men and men in general always want sex, right? And so the conversation around asexuality really allows us to think deeply about, like, maybe we don't all want sex, right? And but this conversation is even more interesting because it intersects with religion. So, like, those are balancing acts. Because, like, at the same time, I'm thinking about, like, if you are such a devoted Christian and, you know, you believe in the word and the word says that you shall lay with your person and make love to them. If you're not making love to them, how do you reconcile that with your religion? So I wanted to know why you wanted to live those two conversations next to each other in this book.
You know, I think asexuality is a painful experience. I think being an asexual in society, and let's get this straight, because people are like, there are people who are asexual. So it was partly to spark that conversation, firstly, because I feel representation matters. As much as our asexual happens to kind of be a villain, in the book, which is also the reason why I made a lot of decisions that I made about Mzwandile there, you know, post the refusal to bury Lerato. It has to do with the fact that, as you're saying, I'm lifting up a topic that, or a subject that nobody wants to talk about, nobody talks about, but there are people who are living this life. Some of them are so, they feel like social outcasts. There's a loneliness that comes with it. There's just like a weirdness, like you're a freak, like you're just not normal. And I think it's important that that what we do as artists is that we lift people up, we take people in the shadows and we bring them to the light so that they know that I'm not the only asexual in the world kind of thing. So a lot of people are like, yeah, but we wanted to see what happens to Mzwandile after. We feel like his story was kind of left hanging. So I had a lot of ideas about what I was going to do with Mzwandile, you know, once he decides that he's not burying this woman and he's just going to pursue his Christian life. But I also didn't want to vilify him to a point where, you know, again, saying, first of all, I'm raising a topic that is hardly ever raised. But then I didn't want to create the sense of, oh, am I asexual? You know, I don't want to be like, they just, there's this selfishness and whatnot. I didn't want to go to the extreme of making this person just look, I mean, I know he already looks bad, but I didn't want to make him look worse than he already did. Because I didn't want the topic to become a joke that, oh gosh, like, just be happy you're not stuck with an asexual, because this is probably what would happen. I just wanted to reflect on the, you know, the fact that we're not all the same. We're not all the same, and we don't always experience sex in the same way. And it goes beyond just not having the same sexual preference, but also that some people's sexual preference is no sex, and it happens, and it's there. And once you talk about, once you bring things like this into the light, then if I'm an asexual, I'm kind of free to now know that if I say to somebody, no, I can't be with you because I just don't have those kind of feelings towards people. I just don't, I cannot, I like you. I love spending time with you, but I'll never have sex with you because I'm just not that way inclined. So that was important to me. And I think I've always had this thing, and I think that's just a personal paranoia of mine, that, you know, when you marry young, you have not come fully into yourself. So when you marry, like when you were in your early 20s, you married young, right? So I must watch my words.
Watch young. That's young, Angela.
That is young,
right? But I'm 28, guys. Is that young?
Listen, this is the point. The point is, especially if you're a Christian and you believe in this principle of waiting and everything, I just have kind of this paranoia that, yes, it's wonderful, you know, if that's a choice that you make as a Christian. But I always think, like, my goodness, What if once you marry, you get all these surprises, like, oh my goodness, this person actually, is not even attracted to women, or is not even attracted to men, you know, or they just don't like sex, or they, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like sometimes religion can be a cover, for people who want to hide who they truly are. It can be a cover. And we know that a lot of people use religion as a cover to hide who they truly are. That is why I actually made Mzwandile's character kind of like the staunch Christian and everything else that I framed around their relationship has to do with just wanting to have that particular conversation.
The relationships in this book are so interesting. I think they're just like a tea for toxic. But I think a lot of that is also linked to the interesting relationship we have with relationships as it comes to temporality, right? So people think that a good relationship is a long relationship. you know. And so if you've been married for 20 years and you've had a good marriage, there's a temporality attached to that, right? It's why people would think that Lawrence and Lerato didn't have anything serious. What they had wasn't real because it wasn't for a long period of time, right? So there's this relationship between temporality and, I guess, what people assume to be, or longevity and what people assume to be a good relationship. And yet in so many of the relationships in this book, there's a counter to that, right? So you see, like grooming, for example, you think of Duke and Norma. Norma was quite young when she met Duke. They've been together for a long time, but they've been toxic for an extremely long time. So there's longevity, but there's also toxicity, you know? Mushidi and Solomzi. Solomzi is like trying to sell his wife to the highest bidder, you know? But they've also been together for a long time. And so I think that there's a relationship between temporality and, I guess, toxicity as well. So I want to talk a little bit about the commentary that you're making about long-standing relationships and the assumption that a long marriage is a good marriage.
I love that question. So like I was saying, that I think a lot of us are reflecting on what happiness looks like. You know, what a person's happiness, what it is that constitutes happiness. And I was watching this study on people who've lived long. So it's a Harvard study where they got a group of men, they recruited them from when they were about in their 20s, early 20s, no, in their teens, late teens, up until, you know, their last days, basically. So they go back every, I don't know, 5 years or whatever to check in on how this person's life is, and they would record each and every one of those lives. And it was a study on happiness. And what they concluded, you know, based on the matrix and whatever that they were measuring and it, like the people's lifestyles and so on, is that a lot of people married, the men that were married lived longest, and they lived they had longer and healthier lives, right? But then as they went deeper into the study, they discovered that the men that were married but were in toxic relationships did not live as long as the ones that were kind of happily married, if we can call it that. And so the measure of happiness is not to the duration of your partnership with your person. It is the duration of you and your partner living in a happy space, in an accepting space, in a loving space together. So, and I think that's what a lot of these studies kind of miss. You know, I do remember for some time people were like, okay, so married men, like you've got to be, there were even jokes and memes and all of that. It's like, okay, a married man is like the happy, the more married a man is, the happier he is. But the truth is, if that man or that woman is married, but they've been miserable for 20 years, they are going to have a stroke. They're going to have high blood pressure. They're going to have all those diseases that come with living a stressful life. So it's not the duration that counts, as you're saying. It's the quality of the relationship that counts. And those are the things that when we talk, we like to generalize in society. We love just making these sweeping statements that married people are happier than single people. No. If a single person is living a life where they can be who they want to be.
Elma's happier than me.
Excuse me?
I think Elma is happier than me because she's married.
I'm happily married. Please underline, it's not the fact that I'm married, it's the fact that I'm happy.
Maybe he's also happy as single, you know? So maybe you're happy as single.
Definitely, if anyone is listening to this, I want a partner ASAP, like ASAP. So,
be careful, you have to list what it is that will make you happy in that partnership. Don't just grab whatever.
No, Zoom screener.
We'll screen.
But I think I'm just saying.
We had a text about how that
goes. I think something so interesting, though, because I think that, you know, people always ask, And look, I mean, my husband and I didn't date for a long time before we got married. You know, we actually got married relatively quickly. And
you've
I think
been
people
married
always,
more longer than you've been dating.
Yeah. So we've been married much longer than we actually dated. And I think that the most interesting thing was that people would always ask me, oh, how long have you guys been together? Oh, wow, you're already getting married. And I think it just goes back to that, right? That there's an assumption that time is like a marker of so many things. So the longer you've been dating, the more solid, you know, your relationship is likely to be, or there's an assumption, right? And I think it's always been interesting because people always want, that's like question number one. How long have you guys been married? Or how long did you date? You know, I think that it's so interesting that we also carry that into relationships as well. So there's like this running meter, right? Like, how long did you date? Things, how long have you been married? It's just this running meter. So, I mean, look, Fred, if you meet someone and you want to marry them after 3 months, I am such an advocate.
But I think a conversation that sits alongside this longevity and temporality is a conversation about ethical non-monogamy. So we find that the straight relationships in the book are under the guise of believing that monogamy is what they want, right? And so some of them end up cheating because, you know, monogamy may not be working for them, but they are so beholden to the idea that they want to be monogamous. And we have this queer couple in the book. Hey, what's up? What's up? And the queer couple in the book, you know, one of the scenes that I really enjoyed in the book was the birthday party and quasi slash the social club that was happening. And the conversation that was really elevated from that was the idea of like ethical non-monogamy, right? So would you rather want to know that your partner wants to see other people and you agree to that? Or would you rather your partner's cheating and you don't know about it? And I want to talk a little bit about that, right, Angela? Why it was important for you to sort of sneakily bring that in. You sneakily brought that in, right? Because it's not at the forefront, but it's something that you laid on the table for whatever people wanted to make of it. But I think it's a really important commentary, right? We live in a world where perhaps, and we've always known this, but perhaps your partner may not be able to give you 100% of what you want, but maybe they give you 50%, and maybe the other 50% you get it somewhere else. Some of us can get it from friendships, but maybe you are like, I want to have an emotional relationship with someone, but this is my primary partner and I want to have secondary partners, but we all know that this is a partnership. Why was it important for you to sort of highlight ethical non-monogamy?
Whatever. No, man. I know, man. I don't know if I agree with the term ethical monogamy. I do know that there is a lot of hypocrisy in monogamy as we know it. And I think my main focus was on the hypocrisy of monogamy as we know it. So you will think back to the conversation that Makumeda has with Norma in the sauna, and she's kind of going on about, oh, you know, it was better in the olden days because for us, monogamy was monogamy. And then, you know, when somebody challenges her and says, well, I mean, if the man was cheating, she's like, yeah, but I mean, men are like that. Men, you know, they are virile, you know, they gotta spread their seed. And that is exactly the conversation. Let's face it. That's exactly what is said. And it's kind of accepted. But then what happens when not necessarily a Lerato and Mzwandile the situation, what happens, let's say, if it's a similar situation, and so the man, because it's expected, you know, he sees somebody younger, she's hot, it's cool, he has a thing, and then if that one ends and has a thing. So obviously at home, that woman is still a human being. She's sitting there, she's, you know, watching this whole thing unfold in her marriage, like a normal situation where she's kind of known that after the Duke, since time immemorial, the Duke's always had a piece on the side. And we know that's across cultures, white, colored, that's why there's words like peace on the side. And if you listen to how flippant, for instance, a phrase like peace on the side, It's like, hi, siyadlala, I'll come back to you. It's okay, just wait and be ready when I get home. But then obviously when it's a woman, which is why I enjoyed meeting all the three women in this book, the strayers, you know, because that's not, yeah, somebody was like, oh, this book is not what I expected. I just knew if it's about marriage and there's a broken ring, it's probably cheating men and da da da. But actually, at this particular phase of the couple's lives, even the Duke is not having anything on the side. He's got like a heist on the side, and that's as bad as it goes. But he doesn't have a mistress. But all the women, Mushiri, she's tempted by Jim Guy, Lerato, it's Lawrence, Norma, tempted by Zim Guy. It's just things are happening. And so when you look at how then society reacts when it's the women, I remember even at the book launch, at my book launch, that people were like, the men were like, no, but why is it the women? Like, that never happens, you know? And somebody was like, no, you're putting ideas into our women's head. I mean, do you really think your woman is just sitting there? There's nothing, there's this blank space. And then I'm going to put ideas, but just with a book, and she's going to run off and cheat on you. You know, obviously not. But the thing is, it suits patriarchy for women to not even consider, don't even think about it, because that's not what a good woman does. A good woman is faithful. She stays the course through affairs, through whatever, she's still there. So I wanted to challenge that hypocrisy that lies in how society portrays how society defines monogamy. Monogamy is a woman being faithful. That's what monogamy is. Right? That's what monogamy is.
I want to talk a little bit about the men. You know.
You mean to say the trashy men, friend? You said the trashy men. You want to talk about the trashy men?
Form, right? I think that almost, you know, when they say life imitates art, it's so true, right? Because the men in this book are so unimpressive. And then you just think of like the men who are always trending on Twitter, and you just realize that this unimpressiveness is just, you know, it's uniform. But these men, I want to talk a bit about Duke, right? I don't understand how there were people who liked Duke. Duke is abusive.
You won't believe it. I also don't understand it. People are like, he should have even gotten away
Is, I think that Duke groomed Norma. So I think that the relationship between Duke and Norma had previously been one of unequal power dynamics. I think that because Duke was older, he groomed her in so many ways, right? And he was older, he had money. That relationship was just unequal, you know? And we often have these discussions about much older men dating women who are younger, who may be of consenting age, but that those power dynamics are weird. Like, if you are a 32-year-old man, you are unlikely to have 18-year-old friends, but you want to date an 18-year-old girl. And there's just things there that are very interesting, you know? And so I'm really curious about Duke as a character. So there are people who really thoroughly loved Duke. I don't know why. Yeah. But for me, I thought that Duke going to prison was like the best way that things would have ended for Duke. So I...
Say it again. Say it louder. Duke got exactly what he deserved.
In the minority of the people that I've spoken to, you are in the minority, believe it or not.
It's weird, right? Because that's something you said as well. And I think that, like, Duke landed up in prison because Duke had self-esteem things that he'd just never gotten over, right? So because they powered their relationship,
it was... Oh, he's a criminal! Criminal end up in jail. That's what happened.
Like, what is this thing where we glorify people who steal from the state and steal from everywhere else because it's cute and they have nice Instagrams, right? Yeah, I'm shading a few people, but it's okay. So I want to talk about Duke, right? Why was Duke the way that he was? Duke is just so annoying.
No,
and have you been surprised by the reaction to Duke?
No, but I made Duke. I think, Duke. Okay, before I, let me not, like, what do they call it? Libel myself. What is it when you put yourself in a position where you could be potentially sued?
Self-incriminating.
But who's going to sue you? People that I know. Put it that way.
Oh, so, no, don't do it. I will advise you against.
Yeah, you is going to sue her.
I need the lawyer kept on now. I need the lawyer kept on. So he's inspired by, I'm going to say people, very specific people whom I've observed and they fascinate me because I suppose it is kind of a prototype of a certain kind of, I'm sorry to say, a certain kind of black man that we have come to know. Like you're saying, people are looting state coffers, but you find people cheering for them. You find people taking days off work just to show how they just adore and idolize these people. So Duke is a man who, money is power to him. And money allowed him to, you know, clinch the Kasi beauty, Norma. You know, obviously Norma is the kind of woman that was hot, is still hot even in her old age. So for somebody like Duke, who's like a thug, like especially at the time that she met him, he was a common thug. But he managed to get the most beautiful girl, Ekasi, or wherever they met, you know. And so it became, it's been clear to Duke from an early age in his life that money is power. Money gives you access to, you know, the kind of women, the most beautiful women in the world, or whatever it is, great lifestyle, great company, you know, obviously Duke, compared, for instance, to the other men in the society, in the stock field, he probably has less education. I mean, he didn't finish school. He's just good at maths, you know, but he's got access to powerful people, learned people, professionals. So that actually takes away that whole, it actually cleans up his image. Like money has cleaned him up, you know? And we know that happens a lot. But also there's a charm to people like that, which is why half the world is falling in love with the Duke. You know, there's a charm to them, and we can't deny that the fact that there are people with that thuggish charm for you, doctor. I see the look in your face. And you know, it's so funny, the kind of women that love the Duke are women that are like intellectuals, like people that I would never have thought. They're like, you, I maybe the Duke, one day if I were in a corner somewhere with the Duke, you know, things would get on. They'd be like, I wanted more sex scenes, literally one more sex scene between the Duke and Norma, because they feel like the Duke has that kind of rough sexiness, you know? Look at your face. So Duke does represent a certain archetype in life, and it does appeal to women, different women that you never think it would appeal to. And fortunately for him, of course, he's with Norma, who is somebody who has been able to overcome their not so lofty beginnings, their not so honorable beginnings, and she's literally managed to kind of clean up their image almost like to a spotless note. It's just the emergence of Danny Visser back into their lives that's kind of torpedoed this perfect picture that they had miraculously managed to build up and make of their lives. And so, you know, when and obviously that's like, again, kind of the old age tale of, yes, you can start with criminality, and you can think that you will get away from that by cleaning it up with a smart wife or a good life, surrounding yourself with people that are respected. But at some point, it's going to come back. It's going to come back and haunt you. And it's going to come back when you least expect it, and it's not going to end well. And, you know, that's basically the storyline. That's Duke's kind of storyline there.
And I also think that, you know, justice is served. Wait again, I can have the Duke like I okay, wait. I mean, really? I'm sorry, but I can't. Like, I did. And I, yo, I don't know, man. And I sort of feel like Norma sort of became a better person after she was unshackled from Duke. I don't know. Like, I just feel like Duke was not only like toxic in his own right, but there was a hold that he had over Norma that he really needed to get out of the picture in order for Norma to be like a good-ish person, you know? Like, and yeah.
No, but I think also if you really want to be very philosophical about the Duke and Norma kind of situation, is that for me, it's also reflective of South African society in a way. What I was talking about, these themes that even emerge in The Blessed Girl, that it feels to me that as Black people, we have become so obsessed with material success, with being the shiniest and the most glittery of them all, and damn what law I have to break as long as I can get away with it. Who I have to step over or who will be compromised. It doesn't matter, because if I end up in the estate and with the holiday home and with the designer clothes, then whatever got me here is neither here nor there. What is important is that I'm here, you know, because in being that avaricious, you lose a lot of what's good about you, I think, as a human being in general. If your end goal is about like making a lot of money, you're definitely going to have to step over a lot of people's toes. You are definitely going to compromise your ethics in some way or other. It is gonna happen. You're not gonna get that billion being nice, you know? And so that was that. I mean, you look at Duke's kid, like Duke and Norma's kid, Jim's kids, you know, the boys like, hey, you know, stock exchange, I'm doing this, and looks down on the maid that raised him, and, you know, just whines, you know. So everything about that family is very superficial. It's very, very superficial. And it's only when Norma is forced to actually look at the people that work for her in a different light. Because first of all, you know, Tabi sends her that "please call me Aloko Zimbabwe," thereby potentially saving the lives, like her husband's life, because we don't know what was going to happen in that robbery. We don't know if they were going to shoot them after they stole and everything. So whether she likes it or not, that phone call, potentially, as much as it led to him being arrested, but it did potentially save his life. So that happens. You can't keep on seeing your helper as a buy one, get one free package. Like, you're gonna have to now acknowledge the person's humanity, because this person has saved your husband's life, you know? And so I think that's where a shift would start to happen, that you start seeing a human being as a human being. And then from there, when he gets arrested, obviously a lot went down, you know. But in the end, she's just, her kids are too grown up. They've got their own issues, so they're not coming back home. So she's left all alone in this massive house. And then these people, Bamotsebela, because she would still not want people to really, 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 really know, you know, as much as he's in jail, and probably people know why he's in jail, but she wouldn't really want people to have like kind of the inside track of what was happening. So the people that she now entrusts with her life, that she now feels know her better than most, is the helper and the daughter, because she went through stuff with them, and they're here. So because they're here, she might as well, you know, live with them and continue with them. So, but then obviously the dynamics between her and these people have changed completely. She sees them. You know that thing of being seen, of somebody moving from not seeing you because you are of low stature to seeing you. So that is kind of the evolution of Norma.
I mean, Angela, you can clearly hear from our discussion that we had a wonderful, wonderful time reading the book. We're grateful that it's not as light as people imagine it to be, because I think often people really take for granted what light reads can do in terms of commentary. And I think Critical But Stable is really that type of book, which does a lot of commentary if you give, if you make it, if you just have a closer read, right? And if you actually look at what is behind the surface, yes, the keeping up with the Kumalos is amazing, but it's actually what is the interior lives of keeping up with the Kumalos, and what do we lose when we buy into a keeping up with the Kumalos?
I also think that for me, there was a sense of having to reimagine new ways of being, right? And those new ways of being relate to success, relate to relationships, even the ways in which we treat each other as families, right? We have to reimagine new ways of being outside of these like very rigid capitalist frameworks of what success looks like, of what a happy marriage looks like, of what a good family may be, you know? And I think that reimagination is so powerful because it means that outside of all of these things that you're being told of what a good family looks like, what does it mean for you to create your own standard of good? What does it mean for you to create your own standard of happy, you know? And I think that this is something that this book does so beautifully as well, to ask the kind of questions that make you ponder and think about having been the Mushidi in your own life, or having been the Lerato in your own life, you know? Or I hope that Mzandile will read this book and be like, I need to check myself before I wreck myself, you know? And there's just things about that as well, you know? So I really enjoyed this book. And I'm so excited to see what is next. For you, I can't wait for another thriller. But I really think that this book is in many ways deceptively simple. Like you would think that you're just reading about a dead woman or dead person, and you're just trying to see who did it. But you come out of there asking yourself real questions, like Letlhogonolo's alluded to. So congratulations. We're quite excited to see what the future holds.
I mean, we definitely have to talk about the long listing, because Critical But Stable has been long listed.
I hate talking about awards.
So it's been long listed. So just from us, congratulations. I know it's a long list, but congratulations on the long list. Before we leave, we just want to give people a taste of Critical But Stable. So is it possible for you to just read the first page, you know, just introduce us to the Kumalos, to the Kumalos.
Kumalos. All right. Okay, so the opening chapter reads thus. It's entitled The Body. The Body. He stares at her quiet, peaceful face. So much love in that face, such passion. This woman embodies everything he ever envisioned love to be. She's caring, intelligent, sensual, a beautiful person inside out. Look at her now. That body underneath those covers, that body's the same. How strange to be thinking about its eroticism at this moment. This is the thing about his body. It always betrays him, even now, the shame of it. Yet she actually is voluptuous, smooth, perfect, naked in his bed. The thought stirs something in him. That his body can be responding so rudely in the circumstances. He collapses to the floor, weeping. Can it really be over? He thinks of all the good times they've shared, the laughs, the kisses, rubbing her feet, the passion. The remains of their meal are still there, their empty wine glasses on the table. As his heart constricts with loss, the tears roll down his face. He is a heap of grief. Suddenly, a new emotion takes over. It is fear. What is he going to do with this beautiful body now lying so still and so finite in his bed? He'll have to call someone. An ambulance? No, too late for that. The police? No, no police. Not for a man like him. Her husband? And say what exactly? Oh, shit, oh, shit. What has he done? That's it. End of chapter.
I mean, Lynn, now what has he done? I'm just like, let's just jump in, man. I'm trying to see what is happening. What is this body? Who does it belong to?
What's cooking
in the kitchen?
Thank you very much, Angela, for allowing us again to, you know, have a different conversation about Critical But Stable, to delve in a little bit more deeply about the characters, because I think there's so much that can be said and that should be said about this book. As Alma said, we look forward to, you know, having you back on the Cheeky Natives to talk about more books and more stories, right? Because we believe that the Cheeky Natives is really a space for writers to sit and talk more deeply about their work, you know. I often recall an event that we did with Manana, who is a musician. And at the end of the event, he was like, you know what, Cheeky Natives, thank you for just giving me a space to talk. And that was really like heartwarming to us, because that's exactly what our platform is for, to give people a space to talk. So thank you for bracing us with your presence.
No, I love it. And one thing I always appreciate with conversations with you guys is that there's really kind of deeper reflections. You are an author's platform in the truest sense of the word, because your analysis of our work, or at least of my work, is always never superficial. I mean, you really kind of delve deeper into the things that, you know, I, as an author, actually wanted to talk about. These are the things I want to talk about when I talk about my books. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And to Cheeky Natives who've listened to the conversation, who love the conversation, you know the best way that you can support an author is through buying their books. And, you know, we love readers. So you can get Critical But Stable from the Cheeky Merchant. And because we love you, this copy that you get will be signed by Angela. So please head over to our website, www.cheekynatives.co.za. Go to the shop and purchase Critical But Stable. And again, thank you so much, Angela.
Thank you, and happy shopping, Cheeky Natives.
Yes.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.